Hello, I'm Greg Johnston, and welcome to Imagining the Past. This series of podcasts recalled from sessions held during the 2019 Historical Novel Society Australasia Conference, held at the Parramatta campus of Western Sydney University on the 26th and 27th of October, 2019. The podcasts were made from live microphone feeds. This session was called The Things We Don't Know, Research Challenges Across Eras. What are the challenges faced in researching prehistory when there are no written records? How do you approach interpreting Middle Age chronicles? Or choose between a plethora of conflicting primary sources when delving into modern history? Isolde Martin investigates the research challenges faced by Ilka Temke, Gillian Pollack, and Pamela Hart when they tried to find the answers that may or may not be known.
Now, I'm going to start with Ilka. So if you'd all like to talk a little bit about what's drawn you to your individual eras, that would be good.
Thanks, Isolde. So I write novels set in... My two novels are set in Iron Age Britain, just on the cusp of Roman invasion and Roman colonisation. So that's 43 to 52 AD. And it is a particularly unique and weird time to want to write about. There's very little fiction set at this time and in this world. And in answer to the question, what drew me to that, I've only written two books in comparison to my esteemed co-panelists who've written many. But I do think that often what draws us to certain periods in history is a bit mysterious and a bit intuitive. For a long time, I didn't know why I was so compelled by this moment. And it's taken a few years to understand what that is. And I think it's to do with indigeneity. So I was very, very interested in Australian indigeneity. I was absolutely fascinated as a younger woman by the idea of totemism and a connection to landscape through a totemic relationship. Then when I lived in England as a young person, I had an experience in the natural landscape of very deep affiliation and recognition, and it prompted an idea, it prompted the awareness that everyone is Indigenous to somewhere. And indigeneity is such a political and complex and difficult conversation in Australia. It's something that there's a lot of sensitivity about, quite rightly. And yet the idea that the kind of awareness that I may have my own indigeneity was quite an epiphany for me and led to the research of this ancestral European place.
Okay, Gillian?
This is a two-part question for me because I have that same emotional pull every writer who uses history in their fiction has to a place and time, and it's not the place and time I research as a historian. So my next novel will have an 18th century in space because I've been fascinated with the 18th century for years, and in fact that was one of my things that I studied as an undergraduate. I'm a medievalist because I had a deep and really pressing intellectual query I had to ask, and it became that first doctorate, and it was, how does society manage massive cultural change in a small space of time? And that was because I started that doctorate in 1983, and we were just getting computers then, and I could see that we were about to change big time, and I wanted a model for that change. So I'm an ethno-historian. I look at cultural stuff, and so I needed to understand the cultural change that you get when you get literacy flung at you big time, which happened in the 12th century. And I looked at a whole bunch of really cool stories to find out how people told stories, to find out what they thought about themselves in time, in space, as people, and how that was affected by the fact that they could suddenly write it down. And that's quite different to... You don't want to put that in novels. You want to put that as part of novels. It needs to be part of the expression in novels, but it's not story, it's analysis. Mm. And so for story, 18th century love, really enjoy anything with dance or food in it. So I have a short story which is based around dancing in a churchyard after the Great Plague. And I use my history, but my historical queries are things that draw me to that history, the things I research. I'm a narrative specialist in the general branch of ethnohistory, which means I look at how we live the lives we live, what we do to express that. Why do we sit in serried ranks like this? Why are you all quiet while I'm talking? Why are you listening as if I might be saying something interesting? I need to know all of that.
Because they paid.
See, the answers aren't always happy answers.
Okay, Pam.
Well, my very first historical novel was about Mary MacKillop, The Black Dress, as Pamela Freeman. It was supposed to be a children's a YA novel, although most of its readers have been adult. And I wrote that because the nuns came to me and said, can you please write a children's book about Mary MacKillop? And being raised as a good Catholic girl, I went, all right, sister. No, because I was really, really interested in her. But that was a one-off, and that was quite a while ago. The Pamela Hart books, which some of my readers are calling the Anzac series, it's lovely when your readers christen things for you. My grandfather was at Gallipoli. And when I was looking at the telegrams that the family got after he was wounded, because he was wounded during the retreat, he got a fever, he almost died, and they got a series of telegrams over the space of about a month. Interestingly, families got a lot more information than that they do now when someone is wounded. Saying he was wounded, he was ill, he was seriously ill, he was dangerously ill, he was still dangerously ill, and then finally out of danger. And reading those, I thought, what would it be like to be the person who got them? And that turned into my first Pamela Hart novel, The Soldier's Wife. And I don't feel in some ways that I have this connection to the period. It was just that every time I do the research for one book, I find these great stories. Mm-hmm. And I go, oh, well, I have to tell that one, you know. Or there's a minor character that I want to know what happens to, and so I have to write their book. So my current one is post-World War I. It's 1923 London, set in the world of the theatre. So Noel Coward, Fred Astaire, Gertie Lawrence, those kinds of people are in it. It's actually what Kate Forsyth, in conversation with me yesterday, called a lemonade book after the grimness of writing about the war for four books. I'm doing the 1920s thing of having a good time.
Ilka, you have written a book set before the Roman invasion, which is what we associate with the Druids, but you have not mentioned the Druid term at all. Now, was this to free you up and get rid of all the stereotyping about Stonehenge and the mistletoe and men in long white dresses with, you know, laurel around them or whatever?
So Isolde mentioned that she was going to ask me that question just in the green room before, and I thought, I had never thought about that, but that's exactly what I did. I wrote about the Druids, I wrote about Druidism, although it has been very much reinvented in the 18th, 19th centuries, and also recently with sort of neo-paganism and neo-druidism and general sort of new wave philosophical thinking. What we know about the Druids originally is very interesting and very valuable and very rich, but I absolutely didn't think I was doing that, but I was. I didn't want to call them Druids because Druids has a whole lot of baggage. And I thought, it's almost a cringy term, Druids, and a whole lot of stereotypes that people would instantly sort of think my book was kind of subscribing to. So I invented a name for them, which was journey people, journey men and journey women, because I felt that their predominant sort of cultural function was a shamanic one, it's one that sort of mediated between the material and the spiritual world in a very kind of pertinent and political way at the time. You know, that wasn't a marginal way of thinking about the world. That was the truth, the kind of reality of their culture and law. So, yes, that's what I did. Yeah.
I noticed when reading Lisa Storr's trilogy that religion plays a great part in it. It was, you know, she had to do a lot of her research from archaeology. Religion plays quite a big part in your book, and you've invented, as you mentioned before. Did that help you because you didn't have so many sources? Or religion was so important back then, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. I mean, there was no differentiation between religion and politics, between religion and science, between religion and morality. But it wasn't... I mean, religion itself has a certain kind of baggage. As a term now, it was more, I would say, a kind of... different apprehension of the world, a spiritual apprehension, an animistic sense of the world. I guess in some ways very similar to what we understand our, Australian Indigenous people to feel, that elements of the natural landscape are imbued with spirit and significance, and the whole physical world is sort of a kind of mythic or spiritual edifice that is meaningful for them. So yes, religion permeated every kind of moment of the book.
Religion in medieval times, I mean, is so strong, but how much do you use that? How much do you cut that out because of the modern reader?
Okay, I don't often use the Middle Ages in my fiction, but I do a lot of... I give a lot of advice to writers who want to. And so what I tell them is, first of all, if you use religion without understanding how medieval religion worked in that time at that place, it's not a universal application of religion to a continent. Mm-hmm. Churches didn't talk to other churches, even if they were within the same diocese. They talked to the person above them. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't a monolithic religion. There wasn't one religion and it wasn't monolithic, both. So take the south of France, because I love the south of France. I use the south of France whenever I can for examples. In that one town in the south of France, which was a town near Béziers, which is the name I forget, therefore, just somewhere near Béziers, the population was about 20% Cathar, about 30% Jewish, and the rest was this mainstream religion we assume imbued the whole Middle Ages. It was only 50% of the town folks. Mm. That's one of the reasons the Albigensian Crusade happened. The church was saying, oh, we can get rid of Raymond de Toulouse. So it wasn't a religious crusade. It was let's get rid of a secular lord by attacking his non-Catholic followers, murdering Jews and Cathars. Easy. So religion was connected with the everyday in a fundamental sense in a number of ways. You hold yourself in a certain way, you move in a certain way, you dance in a cemetery on certain days. This is important. But you don't necessarily do it all consciously. It's not that we're aware of religion in Australia because we like to think we're secular even when we're not. We like to think that Christmas is a day that doesn't affect anybody except to give presents. We subtract ourselves from our religious background a lot of the time. And if we carry that into how we write about the Middle Ages, Then we're writing Australian fiction and it's fantasy set in the Middle Ages. It's Australian. Mm. Unless you actually delve into mindset and say... So I always tell people, find the exact place you want to set this novel, the exact date, the exact location, and research that. Don't say, let's look at medieval religion. Let's look at Béziers in 1290.
Yes. Yeah.
Let's find out who lived there. And I tested this because I don't do things without testing it. That would be rude to writers. And my time travel novel, Long Dot Dock, because I like the south of France, tested that and actually sent Australians back to Long Dock so I could show people that there was a difference in mentality, so you could see Australians against the religion of the Middle Ages and the values of the Middle Ages, yeah. But not the values of the Middle Ages, the values of Saint-Guillaume-le-Désert, yeah. The place, the time.
Yeah. And I think it's important also to remember that there were always heretics. You know, there were always skeptics. There were always atheists. There was not this kind of...
There weren't always atheists. We define atheists in a particular...
Okay.
There were always people who did not believe in God, but they were not atheists in the Middle Ages because it was conceptually impossible because of the way we see the world is based on the way we observe the solar system through pretty pictures and astronomical observations and stuff.
Were people who didn't believe in the spheres.
We don't have any evidence of them from the actual Middle Ages. We have a lot of people who tell me there's evidence, but they've never been able to give me any.
Okay.
Well, certainly by the Tudors you have, because you've got Christopher Marlowe. And there's a little group of atheists.
But that was the big difference between the 15th and the 16th century was the development of we do not have to believe that there's God outside the spheres. That was why Copernicus and Galileo got into so much trouble. That's not that they were saying that the different spheres were in a different order. They were saying God might not exist.
Yeah. Okay. So we're getting on.
They were perceived to be saying that.
Yeah. It was possible to interpret what they said as that.
Yes. And which brings us back to that point of particular time.
Particular place. And 2 centuries later, the other side of the country, completely different things.
Actually, I did my latest book. I don't know whether you knew that, but I did the destruction of Béziers. So I know where you're coming from. Gillian has written a very interesting book called Languedoc.com. And it's about a group of scientists who go back to what year is it?
1306.
And they're not supposed to interact with the natives.
1305. 1305. I don't know my own book.
1406 is the other book.
There's one historian.
No, I didn't write a 1406.
And she has to really stand up for herself to the other members of the team about, you know, what history is to her and historic values and everything. It's a very interesting book. It's worth reading.
I wrote it for historical fiction writers. I got asked, I didn't want to write the Middle Ages. It's my specialisation. I didn't want to challenge myself in that way. But blame the HNSA.
I thought it was an anti-Michael Crichton book.
I had to come up with a thesis title in a great hurry because I had to do a creative writing doctorate to get university work, right? People didn't want to employ a historian to teach creative writing. So I had to get a second doctorate. University of WA said, yes, we're happy to have you. You can do it long distance, which means the disabilities weren't a problem. There was only one problem. I had a beautiful contemporary fantasy, very lyrical, gorgeous thing about dead train lines. And I still want to write that novel one day. And my supervisor said, no, it has to be hard science fiction. So I sent him a joke saying, how about I write an anti-Michael Crichton, anti-Connie Willis novel set in the Middle Ages about time travel? And it was only a joke, folks.
Okay, all right, let's move on. Pam, you have set one of your books in Italy.
I did, yes.
Now, how did you cope with, could you speak Italian? To get the atmosphere of, you know,
no, but it didn't matter that I didn't speak Italian because she didn't speak Italian.
Okay.
And we had the Italian phrases that other people, tiny little Italian phrases that other people use, checked before publication to make sure. She's a journalist based on an actual Australian war correspondent. The first female war correspondent was an Australian called Louisa Mack. And that's what inspired the story. And talking about the things we don't know, how many people here knew that there was a flotilla of Australian ships in Italy in 1917? One. There you go. Well done. Two. guess who they were fighting against? Lieutenant von Trapp.
The real one.
Yes. Oh, yes, the Trapp family singers were a real... They used to perform. Yeah, no, they were real in every way. But you know how he's a hero of Austria? It's because he killed thousands and thousands of people with his submarine in the Adriatic during World War One, including civilians.
To the Sound of Music.
You never look at it the same way, I'm sorry. So she's a journalist working there. And there's quite a lot. I mean, I have to say the naval historian, chief naval historian, was just wonderful, wonderful. They have this thing where they know because they put logs in and then they put the logs back to a central kind of place, they know where every ship was at every hour of every day during the war.
Wow.
And I would go, John, what time would they have got into port? And he would go, well, they came in at 6:35, you know, in the morning, and it was very cold. There was ice on the rigging, and just fantastic information. But she, yes, so she didn't speak Italian, so I didn't have to learn it.
And you didn't have to worry about the sort of, because you're talking about the early 20th century, and Italian slang would have...
What I did do was, what we think of as Italian is Roman, primarily, with some Venetian thrown on top. And so when my Italian-American male character comes in and says ciao to his grandmother in the south of Italy in Bari, she goes, why are you talking like a Venetian? You know. So I was very conscious of the fact that at that point the languages across the country were far more distinct than mm-hmm. they are now, that mm-hmm. the dialect, and there are some people who can't. And this comes from my friend Tania Bartolacci that I went to school with, who had a southern father and a northern mother, and when they got mad with each other and fought, they didn't understand each other. And so she had to translate all of their arguments because she could speak both Salerno, which is the southern dialect, and Venetian. So I was very conscious of that in terms of, World War One. Italy hadn't been a country for very long. And one of my characters, in fact, was on the losing side in the Civil War. So I was conscious of that kind of Italian history in terms of how the Italians who are forced together because of the war interact with each other.
Mm. Your dialogue is such an important part of the writing. Mm. So especially when you've got male characters, getting across the slang and the humour and the banter that you get between males particularly. Mm. Now, this would have been a bit of a problem inventing slang for Druids or whatever. How did you cope with dialogue? What decisions did you make about that?
Yeah, so, I mean, just hearing you speak about this, particularly you, Pamela, I realise the liberation that you experience when you write so far back in time that you can't possibly hope to replicate in any authentic way, say, the spoken dialogue, because we're not even sure what language was spoken then. I mean, it was a sort of root form, Brythonic, that may be similar to, or do have some similarities to contemporary Welsh, but certainly, nothing that we can be sure about. So, but at the same time, I really feel that the duty of the historical fiction writer is to cast a spell. Mm-hmm. To our task is to entrance the reader and, you know, create a convincing world and a world that draws them in. And if we and that feels authentic to the moment. So. And I think, for me, that's largely intuitive. So I had a feeling for the atmosphere and the mood I wanted to create that it was a sort of deeper, sort of more ancient register of speech that I had to try to evoke both in the narrative prose and in the dialogue. And mostly I did that intuitively, but what I was conscious of was tending more towards words, particularly in the dialogue, with a Germanic or an Old English root more than a French or Latin root, just those monosyllabic kind of harder, words like wood or home or thick, these kind of...
Swine, not pig.
Yeah, rather than words like sort of sympathy or compassion or these kind of polysyllabic words that didn't ring true to the spell I was trying to cast.
How much did you three, well, not Gillian so much, but consult experts? Did you find particular... archaeologists coming out of the...
Naval historians and, you know, people
and
like that.
From your point of view too, Pam, you had, you know,
huge
so
amount.
Many sources.
So many sources.
You know, evaluating and deciding what
yes.
to use.
I would like to say something about the dialogue
yes,
thing, though.
Do.
It's not, as you said, not just the dialogue, it's also the internal discourse of the character that that is an issue. And one of my characters was this Italian-American boy, young man who had grown up in New York. And when I did the research and read contemporary novels, which is my way of researching dialogue for the period, they don't swear, those nice Italian boys in New York. But trying to write his dialogue and his internal discourse where he would actually have said golly or gosh or and he just sounded so young, you know, he just sounded like a baby. And I had to really make that decision about do I go with the authenticity of golly gosh or do I have him go, oh, damn it. And I went with damn it. You know, because other people in New York would have been saying damn it at that time and other things as well. So it's not inconsistent. You know, I mean, there will be people who could say it, and I just decided he was one of them because I was having this real problem of perception of him as a character.
Which would break the spell.
Which would... Mm. Well, it's not... No, it wasn't about breaking the spell for me. It was about... The reader appreciating him accurately as the kind of person he actually was.
So the reader being a reader, not an historian.
Yes. Mm. That I wanted the reader to understand what kind of person he was. And if I had him saying things like golly, they would not be perceiving him accurately. Mm. They would be perceiving him as younger, naive, or which he wasn't, you know. So that kind of thing, I think you have to sometimes...
The swearing is a big, could,
big thing.
Could
yes.
I add something it's medieval? Because
yeah.
is anybody actually using the Middle Ages in their stuff? Because if you don't know, nobody raises their hands, I won't give you this example because it's not useful for you. Yes,
yes.
We have one person. We have more
Two,
than one.
Three, four.
Okay.
Are you writing
dialogue.
Middle Ages?
If you're using the Middle Ages at all in your fiction. Oh, lots of people.
Okay.
Yes, okay. So... people think the Middle Ages hasn't left much in the way of information because it's nothing like the impossible amounts that you get for modern history. But there's quite a bit for things like dialogue. There are lots of hinty places if you know where to look. They're just not the places that most historians use because they're not looking for dialogue. That's why there's a big gulf between what historians know and what fiction writers need to find out. So the place, if you want to have someone swearing madly and a person with really off language, there's a whole lot of satirical works in Old French which have many, many interesting descriptions of buttocks and stuff. Mm-hmm. And there are so instead you don't have to read the Old French, you read the modern studies of those works. And if you want to know how people swore at each other on the battlefield, which is really handy in novels, especially if you have a fight, because it applies to any fight scene, okay, I'm the person you talk to because I'm the person who analysed it in the Chanson de Geste, in the epic legends. There's a formal way of starting a fight scene where one person said something rude to the other, then the other person says something rude back, then they escalate and say something more rude, then they escalate and say... And it's a four-part thing, and you don't fight until you've given the worst insults possible.
It's true for gang fights now.
It's true, but the
trash
insult... Trash talk is still
point.
There. This is a deep cultural thing. This is why I know about it, because I look at the things that last in culture.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that writers ask me most often. How are people rude to each other? And it's my most popular article in the whole world. About 20,000 people have investigated how you can be rude in Old French. But the important thing is that you can use modern... fight scenes to set up how it escalates, and then because anger doesn't change, because stirring someone doesn't change, but then you can find the right terminology.
The need to get the adrenaline going to the point where you are brave enough to engage.
But you can't use things like damn it. You have to use things like, one of the things I should not be saying in public because it's so rude, you evil liar son of a prostitute glutton.
Yes, a string of insults.
No. But glutton is one of the worst ones possible, and that's not for us. No. We like our food.
Mm-hmm. Because, you know, in Australian, when you're writing Australian history, you know, you see in the books, God, damming or ISA, and often the dam has got, you know...
Oh, yeah, mucked up, yeah. Well, 1923, you know, I have someone saying bloody in front of a young lady, and she goes, and he goes, oh, sorry, you know, because that was rude. It was very rude.
And you need to know what you're doing when you're reading historians, because I have seen a writer use, and they will, you are not in this, they are not in this room, don't worry, they're the other side of the world. And they saw what they thought was damn God as an insult. And so they wrote damn Dieu in their novel. It actually was Lord God, Domine Deus, in old French, came out as damn Dieu.
I would say one thing about experts is that experts are often very generous with their time, and you can find many of them. But if you're going to ask someone who is not a fully employed person, like someone who's not full-time at a university, or my naval historian who's a full-time member, please offer to pay them. Because, you know, they have to make a living, and if they're not being fully employed. Same if you're asking them to do an authenticity read of your manuscript, you should definitely ask, what are your rates? Because we don't want to leech off people.
Fair enough, too. So, with your, I think we didn't quite answer sources.
So many sources. I think one of the big things to remember is that people lie. So, for example, that we have a huge number of letters coming back from both the hospital. This book is set predominantly in a hospital in Heliopolis Palace in Cairo, and we have an enormous number of diaries and letters and things coming out of that place, many of which are lies, because people wrote diaries knowing they would send them back in instalments to their family, and they certainly obviously wrote letters, and they didn't want people to worry. So a lot of the letters from the front, for example, they just lie. Oh, we're having a lovely time. We're splashing around in the water at Gallipoli. You read these letters and you go, yeah. They often make it a big joke about the lice, which were horrendous. They called them chats. So when you're looking at sources, never just take one, particularly for a relatively easily accessible period. But you also always have to ask, What are the intentions of the person writing this piece? Which is why I love photographs. This photograph on the cover was actually taken by one of the nurses in the hospital. Lil McKenzie, fantastic woman, was a very keen amateur photographer. And so when I'm recreating the palace, I had a huge number of actual photographs of the rooms, the women, the drivers, the ambulance, the theatre, operating theatre. The King of Belgium's suite was the operating theatre. So photographic evidence is fantastic.
Yes.
But when you're accessing primary sources, you always have to ask yourself, why were they writing it? And try often to balance out so you get what the men are describing of the hospital to their families versus the hospital reports about the overcrowding and the understaffing and, you know, all that kind of
this
stuff.
This gets into the difference between the way most historians work and most fiction writers work. When you're starting your historical research as a fiction writer, not you specifically, but fiction writers in general, there's an assumption that we tell story, they tell fact. Historians are not about fact. It's a complex, dynamic conversation with the past and with other historians across a long period of time. It's a complex and difficult discipline. It's not about discovering facts, but it gets discussed by the public as discovering facts. So if you asked me what happened in a hospital at this time, I'd be assessing the evidence in the way Pamela just did. And I would be asking, is any of that evidence real? What's the evidence for this actually being written on the spot at that time? Anybody actually being there? Why is this being written? Who for? So this facts of the past thing is basically journalism. And it's really important for us To get into history, we need to believe.
And as writers, that we're going
real,
for the specific.
We need a sense that there is truth and reality and absolute stuff there. But you take that to an historian and you say, you're an expert in the Middle Ages, you must know the facts about Richard the First reign. And I say, well, are you talking about that amazing story where, which is why he was called the Lionheart, where he ripped the heart out of the lion's chest and held it in front of the guy who had imprisoned him? Do you mean that? Because well, that's a really interesting story, and I've got two different sources for it. Or I've got three sources that say that Richard I called his lineage the one that came from demons. That's a facts for historians, depending on what sort of historian they are. I'm an ethno-historian.
See, I go for the demon story every time.
Well, he said it himself. We have eyewitnesses who said that Richard I claimed he was descended from a demon.
Well, he did hate his father.
Well, no, it was his mother's family.
That with Elizabeth Woodville, the White Queen, they're saying, you know, that it's from a Melusine or somebody.
Yes. And that was the family that was there. So it wasn't a demon, it was a supernatural being. Mm-hmm. And I write fantasy and science fiction, so of course that's the story I'm interested in as a writer. But it's not facts of history. It is facts of history. These are things that people...
stories. But it's the stories
All of history is story. There's no distinction between them. What the distinction is between how you look at them, whether you look at them to tell stories, which is us as writers, or looking at them to interpret and analyse, which is us as historians. It's not about the facts of the past, because the past is past. How can we prove it?
Can I just come in about medieval chronicles? Bear in mind... but they often had an agenda. Historians always had biases, whatever the period. But often that person was writing in a distant monastery and hearing snippets from travellers. Mm. Or it might be something like the arrival of Edward IV, which is a political treatise written by the winners. So bear in mind what that person's agenda is too. Because 15th century history particularly is cobbled together by historians, little bits in letters. I mean, there's a thing in a letter saying, the Duke of Buck maketh himself as big as he can. Well, what's that supposed to mean? Is it he's got army? Is he eating a lot? You know, they're snippets, and they're what the people have heard or believed. They're not necessarily facts or truth. Again, that bears up what you said.
There's one major historian, Henry of Huntingdon. 12th century is my baby. 12th century is a thing where I actually know stuff that other people know. And Henry of Huntingdon was notorious and wonderful for having looked at all the available sources, travelling around to all the monasteries, all the places there were books, and looking at all the books for the stuff he wrote about. And then Geoffrey of Monmouth came along within his lifetime and cited a book that Henry of Huntingdon had not seen, and he wrote Arthur. He brought Arthur to everybody. And this has caused controversy since the 12th century.
And let's face it, Geoffrey of Monmouth was a hell of a storyteller.
He was a hell of a storyteller, and he didn't quote something that Henry of Huntingdon had seen, so nobody knows if it's real or not. And of course,
if it was Welsh.
Whether it had needed to be real.
And medieval historians wrote to, you know, as a moral story. They weren't so interested in the truth, but in preserving authority and the hierarchy of things, and teaching people some moral truth. And it's not until you get the proper historians coming in who are interested in history for history's sake. I mean, some of the early historians put speeches in people's mouths too.
Those speeches were put in people's mouths right to the late 19th century, which means it isn't a matter of modern or medieval. Every single historian is working from an agenda. It's just that sometimes the agenda is to get a university job, and sometimes it's to get patronage from a king.
Also, too, Polydore Virgil destroyed all the existing histories, it said. I don't know how true that is. So that anybody writing, you know, a lot of the chronicles and histories of England in, say, the 14th, 15th century may have ended up on the bonfire, too. Mm. So, you were going to talk about the Romans, weren't you? You've said it. Yeah.
Okay. I think we're on question.
Do any of you belong to any particular societies? Have you found any particular journals very helpful? What about the medievalists on the internet?
Okay, medievalist.net is a popular group that translates a lot of the academic world into popular stuff, which means it's very handy for writers. You can't trust everything that goes up there. I'm a columnist for it. You can't trust it. My columns are my columns, and I'm a fiction writer. But I'm writing as a medievalist and an historian for the columns, which doesn't help you either. So it's a popular interface for academia and the rest of the world. And that's the sort of thing you're after when you want to talk to specialists. You find the popular interface and find the specialist who can actually talk about the aspect of the thing you want through that. Because so many people come to me as a medieval historian and say, you're a member of the MLA, you're a member of the Arthurian Society, yes, we can talk to you about everything. And no, I don't know everything, it would be nice.
I hope you enjoyed this discussion. If you would like to know more about the Historical Novel Society Australasia and our numerous activities to promote reading and writing historical fiction, please visit our website www.hnsa.org.au. There you'll also find full biographies of our podcast participants under the tab News and Interviews. I'm Greg Johnston, and thank you for listening to this podcast.